Hello, everyone, and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I am your host, Fatabile Mtombeni, coming to you live from Harlem, USA. I'm really glad you've chosen to join me today. Today's topic concerns one of the most dire issues to face our economy in decades. Owning a home, long considered the pinnacle of the American dream, has become the American nightmare for many families. What happened? Who is to blame? What are your options once the bank comes knocking? What should you know before you sign a mortgage to protect yourself in the future? My guest today is Raymond Matoda. She is the former Chief Administrative Officer at IndyMac Bank, who has founded and currently heads Asset Plan USA, a company dedicated to educating its clients about the latest in housing market and regulation matters. I am honored that she has agreed to join us to clear the air on what happened and give us her expert perspective on how to navigate the mortgage minefield. You are listening to guitar legend Michael Gregory. The song is aptly named Take Me Home from his album Toward the Sun. Listen and enjoy as everyone gathers. I'll be back with you in just a moment. And welcome to the show. I really do have a lot to talk with you about today. We all do. My guest is here on the show, Ray Matoda. I'm very honored to welcome her to the show today. She's a recognized expert in the housing industry, and I'm sure that you will truly benefit from listening in today's show and from calling in when you have questions. We're going to start out by talking with Ray for a few minutes and then in a little bit have time for your questions. Ray is joining us over the phone from sunny Southern California, and I'm coming now to unmute your mic, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Great. I'm so glad that you have the chance, the opportunity to be with us today to talk about a topic that weighs heavily on the minds of so many people here in the United States and around the world, really. Let's get started. I'm certainly not an expert on mortgages. That's why I called you, but I've been doing some research, and I understand that at some point regulations in the mortgage industry were relaxed and that over time practices in the industry became increasingly risky in terms of thinking about what happened. So I want us to start by talking about what happened to bring us to the point where we are right now. Is there a nutshell kind of layperson friendly explanation for what happened?
You know, Batabile, may I call you Tabi, by the way?
Oh, go ahead.
Fantastic. After all, we went to school together. I can't help
myself.
Tabi, the way I would sort of describe it is, you know, it was sort of too much of a good thing that went wrong. And frankly, what went wrong with the housing market here in the U.S. is something that is quintessentially a part of a capitalistic market. all of us, sort of looked back at the rearview mirror and noticed that in America, home prices had not gone down on a national basis for something like 70 years.
Wow.
So and starting in the early 90s, we've had tremendous economic liberalization and the opening of markets and economies across the world. So as the U.S. started to see some lower interest rates under our former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan in the early 2000s after the bursting of the Internet bubble and home prices started to go up, many people thought that was their best chance to jump in. Home prices were going up, mortgage rates were still affordable, and people thought, look, if I can afford home ownership now, I better jump in because who knows if I can afford it in 2 years.
Right.
Those that bought in benefited a lot, okay, because prices went up when they needed to sell. They made a lot of money, especially relative to the amount of money they had put in, because, as you know, most Americans don't actually buy their homes cash down. They only put 5, 10, or 20% down. And really everybody did well. Homeowners did well for a while. Mortgage lenders did well. Wall Street did great. Selling loans on the back end, even mortgage loan investors did well. Certainly real estate professionals and mortgage professionals did well. After 3 or 4 years of that going on, people started to think that home prices had been going up a lot. And was this really real? And frankly, you know, I tend to think human beings sort of culturally tend to be too optimistic when things are going well.
Sure.
And too pessimistic when things are not going so well. And frankly, I think we all got a little too optimistic and didn't quite follow our gut, which said, this smells like something that's too good to be true. And that's what it turned out to be.
Right. Well, you know, the way that you're talking about it, people jumping into the market, buying, and then jumping out at the right point, it was sort of like a game of musical chairs.
Indeed. Indeed. In fact, you know, I would tell you, there wasn't anyone you would see. You would literally be standing on a bus, you know, after paying 25 cents to jump on it, and the people next to you would be talking about the home they were planning to buy or how the houses in their neighborhood had gone up so much. You know, the Southwest Airlines check-in line had people talking about this.
Right.
So it truly became something that, your average middle-class American was talking about, and I think there was a lot of speculation on many dimensions.
And part of the problem, I guess, then, is that you had people jumping in who really were not equipped. They didn't have the financial sophistication, you know, the background to know how to evaluate risks, to know whether they actually had the cushion to be able to survive if something went wrong and the market tanked, which it did.
You're exactly right. I mean, first of all, I would tell you, mortgages are a very complex thing. You know, here I am, right, with a Princeton economics degree and all kinds of education. And when I bought my first house in 2002, I was confused. And I'm good at math.
Oh, man.
Okay. But you're absolutely right. You know, I remember getting my first house in 2002. We got two loans. We put, I think, 5% down. Our first loan was 6.5%, I want to say. And our second loan was 7.5%. And we thought those were good rates. By the way, today that rate would be considered quite high because we have mortgage rates at historic lows. Mm-hmm. What ended up happening subsequent to that was as home prices started to go up, everyone was very concerned at who was going to be left out of home ownership. And so the private market jumped in, and regulators and policymakers looked on and supported, and everyone wanted our minorities, you know, people who didn't have huge down payments, to also to be able to get in. And what began with a good idea... Mm-hmm. The Alt-A's, the so-called Alt-A and subprime home markets, over time became very risky for many of the people involved. But they started out as a good idea, trying to get people that traditionally wouldn't qualify under very conservative standards to get into a home.
But you're getting me into what I wanted to ask you about next, which is about responsibility. You wrote an article in 2008 that was published on a blog called FlippingFrenzy.com talking about responsibility, and at that time you wrote that you believed that the heads of the big banks were not really the root of the problem, yet I think when people are looking for, responsibility and who to pin it on, you know, there's this lawsuit against Deutsche Bank that has made big news recently, folks do look to the investors, the big investment banks that made an awful lot of money bundling the loans and selling them, which were insured by the government, which meant being insured by taxpayer money. So there's all of that that's involved, and then there are people who were not sophisticated in the market who got into it at all. What should we be thinking about in terms of responsibility? Who's really responsible here?
You know, first of all, let me clarify. I am not one who has said or believes that the banking heads are not responsible at all. Mm-hmm. I can only comment on a situation which I am personally familiar with. And what I talked about in that blog was the company that I was at, which I believe was an honest company with
yes.
good intention. So that's really what I was talking about. And the comment I was making was that it had become very fashionable, and it's still quite fashionable, just to blame a small number of players involved in the housing market, particularly those that were making millions off of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess at the simplest level, Tabi, my statement would be everyone was at fault.
Okay.
You know, consumers got felt, you know, like this was too good of a thing, and a lot of people speculated on housing. So people would put in 0% down, 3% down, buy a $750,000 house with the intention of flipping it, so to speak, within a couple of years to get rich.
Mm.
Mortgage loan officers and realtors certainly fueled the frenzy. I didn't see anybody scaling back. And in fact, there was quite a lot of fraud in the marketplace with people selling loans in particular, which they did not explain properly to consumers. I certainly believe some of the people at banks, particularly those that were aware of people getting loans that they shouldn't have qualified for, were at fault. But generally speaking, look, I believe everyone was at fault. The banking industry, the regulators, policymakers, and Fannie and Freddie, you know, who shouldn't have taken the type of risk they took on, which ultimately ended up being the responsibility of taxpayers, although I got to remind you that at the time they were taking on these risks, they were you know, publicly owned, shareholder-owned companies, and the guarantee behind their debt was really more implicit. And it's really subsequent to the housing crisis starting and this big financial panic that took place that became more of an explicit guarantee. In fact, I want to tell you something. I think our government actions exacerbated the economic damage to America because we let the psychological issue become as big or bigger, frankly, than the real issue.
Well,
so I think part of the issue here is psychological.
Right. Well, you know, you're absolutely right. When people are afraid, when they panic, you know, it's sort of by definition, they're not behaving rationally. And mm-hmm. so that can lead to irrational decisions that lead to, you know, really unfortunate situations. But I'm interested in what you're saying about this insurance being implicit to begin with and then becoming explicit, because that's something that I hadn't been aware of. You know, in doing my research, I looked into some of the reporting about what happened with Deutsche Bank. And just for background for folks who don't know, what happened is that at some point, I think it was around 2008, Deutsche Bank purchased a mortgage company called Mortgage IT. And so that sort of is the crux of the problem, the practices of Mortgage IT in terms of vetting potential home buyers and certifying the loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I believe is what happened, when they knew or, you know, didn't do the due diligence to make sure that the home buyers could actually afford these mortgages. So my understanding from reading these articles was that there was an expectation that these loans were going to be insured by the government, but I'm hearing something a little bit different, that at the beginning it was more implicit and only became explicit later on. Can you talk to me about how that happened?
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, traditionally, let's talk about the three big government-owned or backed lenders today. They are Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and FHA. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now do have an explicit guarantee from the government. In fact, the Treasury Department has put in, I believe, something over $130 billion into them already.
Billion
and they have the authority to put up to $400 billion
wow.
to back shareholder losses related to loans that were made by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Fannie and Freddie were really these private shareholder corporations, which, as I said, they've been traditionally called the GSEs, government-sponsored entities, not government-owned entities, but government-sponsored entities. They were sort of the quintessential public-private experiment gone wrong, where essentially what you had was private shareholder losses. For instance, Warren Buffett was one of the most famous shareholders of the GSEs, but you had the private market take most of the profits of these two corporations. And when the market went south, the size of their investments was so huge and their role in the U.S. housing markets was so huge that the Treasury Department and the government explicitly had to step behind and back them, because if they had disappeared, the entire mortgage finance market would have gone down the toilet.
Wow.
And completely frozen. FHA, now the Federal Housing Administration, has always been explicitly government-backed. So that is really the true government lender that has operated in the marketplace, and its role has also become much more important. In fact, more than 90 out of 100 loans that are originated today are made by Fannie, Freddie, or FHA. But it's good to remember that until September of 2008, Fannie and Freddie were not explicitly backed by the U.S. government. It was only in 2008, just like 3 months before that, IndyMac, the bank I used to work at, went into a tailspin and, because of a financial panic, was taken over by the FDIC. A very similar thing happened to Fannie and Freddie in September of 2008. They were taken over by FHFA, their regulator, and the government had to back them to keep the housing market from completely, like I said, going into a black hole.
And a lot of that, as you're saying, was fueled by panic from the market.
Indeed. You know, the one thing I do want to mention, it's sort of very, very interesting, goes to fundamental nature of capitalism. And I got to start by saying, you know, I still remember the day I took Econ 101 with Ben Bernanke at Princeton, Tabi, after I met you. And so I'm a big fan of capitalism. I grew up in India, and I'm a big believer that capitalism is, in fact, the system which does maximize the size of the pie, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
The issue, you know, I have other issues with capitalism, my big one being inequality. I don't think the split of the pie is indeed fair. But let's put that aside for a second. There are two perfectly legal ways of making money within capitalism. I like to call them economic value add, and the second one is arbitrage. I'm not including fraud and violations of law. Clearly, people engage in fraud and still make money in capitalistic economies. Let's put that aside for a second. I believe one of the core causes of the housing crisis was the arbitrage mentality.
Okay.
Everybody thought they were passing on the risk to somebody else, and nobody wanted to say no to that, you know, minority, lower-income borrower who was borrowing with no skin in the game, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
People were able to borrow without putting a dollar down. You know, so in some ways, at least the first wave of the housing crisis, which was driven by subprime, the subprime crisis, was about consumers having been given loans for too low of a price, having bought homes that they couldn't afford.
Right.
And really, it's the second phase of this crisis which is different. It is now unemployment-driven. So when we talk about the crisis, let's talk about the two different phases. The first phase being of people that had bought homes that they couldn't afford, whereas the second being of people that had bought homes they could afford, but they later could not afford them because they were laid off or became underemployed.
Okay. That's a very important distinction to make, and we will get into that as we come into the second part of the show to talk about what this means to individuals. But right now I have a caller, and it looks like the caller wants to be on the air. Let me explain for those of you who decide to call in. The phone number is 818-532-9789. If you want to be on the air, you press the number 1, and I get a little icon. It's a raised hand. It's really cute, and it tells me that you want to be on the air. If you don't want to be on the air, you actually can listen to the show over the telephone. Just dial the number, but don't press 1. If you do press 1, I will come to you. So this is a person in the 707 area code, and I hope that you actually do intend to be on the air. Your mic is on, 707 area code. Welcome to the show. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to the show. Do you have a question for Ray?
Hi, Batabele. It's Joy Berkmeyer.
Hi, how are you?
Moving forward, I know we don't have a lot of time. I did not get involved in any of the problems of foreclosure, bad loaning. We took a mortgage on our house 3.5 years ago. At that time, we got a mortgage with Countrywide, and everything was paid, everything was done. They offered us a 4-year fixed on a 30-year later adjustable.
Okay.
At that time, our property was valued at appraised at $350,000. So we had plenty of equity because all we owed was $127,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so we felt comfortable because if we wanted to sell the house over the next 4 years, it was worth $350,000. Well,
so
what has happened is that everything depreciated.
Okay.
We're not in default. We're still on that same loan. Countrywide transferred it over to Bank of America. We've paid on time. Everything is fine. But the interest rates went down, so we wanted to refinance.
Okay. Sounds like a smart idea.
Yeah. So when we went to refinance, I'm not the owner, but I spoke for the owner and made inquiries about refinancing his house, which he put into a trust, a house-specific trust for his grandchildren. And because of his age, he was ready to turn the trust over to the grandchildren.
Okay.
So the question was, how now does the trust qualify to refinance this mortgage? The mortgage is in this individual's name.
Right.
I started making inquiries, and every loan company, the minute I mentioned the house was in a trust, they hung up on me. The minute I said it's not in default, they hung up on me.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I get a company that says, oh, yes, we can do this. If you can find a borrower with good credit, we can put him on title and go forth and give you a low interest rate. And he knew that the house was in a trust. So I found somebody who was willing to, with good credit, and we talked with the loan company, and they checked his credit, and I said, oh, great, great. Now we need you to give us a deposit.
Mm-hmm. Now, Joanna, I'm very sorry, but we're running short on time. What has happened? I mean, what is the concern that caused you to call in?
They went ahead and lied to us. They told us that this fellow with good credit could assume this mortgage and took a deposit from him to hold the interest rate, only to find out that they never talked to the owner who held the mortgage, and they took a deposit from somebody who doesn't even own the house. And when I called Bank of America, they said, no, this mortgage is only assumable by a direct relative.
So the
what
company
happened is,
mm-hmm,
the company took the deposit and went ahead, and so now this is, I can't get a straight answer from anybody.
So let me see if I understand this correctly. You have this company that said that they were going to be able to refinance the loan. They took the deposit, and it turns out that they perhaps didn't have the authority to do that.
Right.
So let me ask.
They weren't talking to the owner. They
right.
were never. They took a deposit from somebody who is not on title, saying, "We'll put him on title if he has good credit."
So, Ray, let me ask you.
I mean, guys, honestly, this sounds to me like fraud. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things we have to tell all of the listeners here is never give people money without a written commitment or contract. So my question to the lady on the phone, to the caller, would be, what, based on what contractual obligation was the deposit made? I would really encourage her, based on the few facts that she's shared, to call some of the government agencies that could help her on fraud, like the Department
That's
of Housing and Urban
question.
Development.
Yep. I haven't gotten an agency that I can call. I have no idea. I've called Bank of America. I've called here and there. I've called everybody I can. Nobody will give me the name of who to call so I can report this.
I think you should call the Federal Trade Commission, my dear. So the places I would start are the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. One of those two entities will tell you where to go next.
And, you know, let me jump in here for a second on that as well. I have a blog that is related to the show. It is untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. And what I've done in the past week is to put up links to the FTC where they have these wonderful videos that are very plain, you know, very easy to understand, that tell consumers how it is that you can report this kind of thing to the FTC and have it looked into. And later on in the show, Jana, we are going to focus on resources, both in terms of understanding...
Okay, I don't want to take time because I know that this is slightly off subject, but if
You know what, Sweetie, you brought up something that is absolutely on subject because we do want to talk about how people can avoid being ripped off. And so you brought up something that's really important. I want you to hang on and make sure to listen, and then I can actually get back to you after the show. If you have more questions, we can talk more specifically about your situation. How's that?
Beautiful. Thank you, as always. You're wonderful.
Great. I just want to quickly tell you, Jana, you could call 1-877-FTC-HELP.
1-877-FTC-HELP.
Yes.
Got Federal
it.
Trade Commission's helpline. 1-877-382-4357. I just looked it up, Toby, if you don't mind. I thought I'd just share it with you.
That's 1-877-382-4357. Thank you very much.
You're so
very
welcome.
And thank you for calling. All right. That actually, you know, is one of the reasons why I'm doing this show, is that I've been hearing from people who have experienced unfortunate encounters with folks who are not honest. You know, what Joanna, our caller, brought up is one of the unfortunate results of what has happened with this crisis. Ray, we're going to need to take a break for just a moment, and when we get back, we can talk a little bit more about now, you know, what happens with consumers, what can individual people do, and what suggestions you have for how this situation can be resolved. So if you
absolutely.
Don't mind, you're good?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Sounds
we're
great.
Take a bit of a break. And for those of you who are on the line waiting to ask a question, we will get to you when we come back. So when we get back, yes, we're going to talk about how the mortgage mess impacts the average person. Today on the show, I'm featuring music by the master guitarist and gifted singer Michael Gregory. I had the pleasure of hearing him play at the Cornelia Street Cafe with Brandon Ross as part of the Undead Jazz Festival last summer here in New York City. He's a truly wonderful musician and a wonderful person as well. For more information about him and the music that you're hearing today, visit the show's blog, our show's blog, untangledresolutions.blogspot.com, and that's Untangled Resolutions, one word. The piece I'm playing now is called Message to Me, and it's sort of a pep talk, and I thought it would be great to talk or to play today as we're talking about situations that folks can find really depressing. And it comes from Michael's CD called Towards the Sun. We will be back in just a moment.
Rescue for me if you need me. So you're never gonna have to.
everybody. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Untangled Resolutions presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about the social and financial issues that concern you most. I'm your host, Batabi Levantombeni, relationship coach and divorce mediator, and I'm broadcasting live from Harlem, USA. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in relationship negotiation and divorce mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I will guide the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. Work out your child support and parenting issues without spending years in court. For more information, visit my website, www.123untangled.com. That's www.123untangled.com. I have a couple of announcements for you. First, on June 12th, that's next Sunday, the Peace of Heart Choir will be giving its spring benefit concert at the Ida K. Lang Recital Hall in the North Building of Hunter College here in New York City. The concert is from 5 to 7 p.m. Now, I know that that concert directly conflicts with the live airing of this show, but it is a very worthy cause, so I am putting that aside to tell you about it so that those of you who are here in New York City next week can go. The choir is unique for a number of reasons. It was founded just after the 9/11 attacks here in New York City as a response to a need for community healing. The group brings together people from all sorts of backgrounds, and the choir has performed songs in Arabic, English, Haitian Creole, Hebrew, Spanish, and I believe that they might be singing a song in Tamil at next Sunday's concert. So your tickets to the concert would include complimentary snacks before the concert and during intermission, and it's a chance to experience really great music while supporting a very good cause. For more information, visit the choir's website at peaceofheartchoir.org. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I will have to tell you that I happen to sit on the board of trustees of this very fine organization, but rest assured that I would have told you about the choir regardless. So if you are in the city next Sunday, do consider attending the Peace of Heart Choir Spring Fundraiser at Hunter College. Visit peaceofheartchoir.org for all the details. I also want to let you know that my friend and virtuoso saxophone player Ross Moshe is curating this month's series of performances at the University of the Streets here in New York City as well. Visit their website, universityofthestreets.org, and that's all one word, universityofthestreets.org, for information about performances and to buy tickets. Roz himself is performing tomorrow night at 8 p.m., and he's followed by a group called Naked Women, which apparently has no women in it, naked or otherwise. Now, I call that false advertising myself, but I visited their MySpace page, and they sound like a great group, so I suggest you go. Most gigs are $10, and the musicians are really top-notch, so it's a real bargain here in New York City. And so the website is universityofthestreets.org, and if you happen to be in the city this month, I suggest that you go to the University of the Streets to hear this fantastic music. Speaking of bargains, I'm bringing Ray back onto the show. We're talking with Ray Matsuda, who is an expert on the mortgage industry, and we're talking about how folks can avoid a ripoff, getting ripped off here in the mortgage market. Ray, speaking of bargains, a lot of people got into trouble with their mortgages at the moment that they signed them when they thought that they were getting a bargain. We talked a bit about these, you know, zero down loans and 3% loans and so forth. What have your clients told you about how they got in trouble?
You know, for the most part, Toby, I run into more of the people that didn't get into trouble on the day they signed their mortgage, but really are people suffering as a result of underemployment and unemployment. I mean, you know, I'll give you a couple numbers to kind of, quote-unquote, prove the point.
Sure.
We have 4.3 million people today that are delinquent on their first mortgage by more than 90 days that have not been foreclosed on. 4.3 million people.
Wow.
I believe these are all people that are employed or underemployed or unemployed. And the way that I prove that is by using a New York Times number, which told me that there are 6.2 million Americans that have been unemployed for more than 6 months. These are what they call the long-term unemployed. If you actually take the 6.2 million number and multiply it by the current U.S. home ownership rate, which is a pretty fair assumption, you're saying I'm thinking the people that are long-term unemployed were probably homeowners at the same rate as the rest of the U.S. population.
Right.
When you multiply those two numbers, you get 4.1 million. So it is my belief that the 4.3 million people that are more than 90 days delinquent on their mortgage today are all largely the unemployed or the underemployed. So what we're facing today is really an unemployment problem, not a rip-off problem.
Okay, so we're not talking about the folks who, you know, got sort of sucked in with these zero-down loans and never really had the resources to pay for them, but people who actually had the resources to afford their loans at the time that they signed the loan, and now with the meltdown affecting the job market, they find themselves unable to pay their loans.
Indeed, exactly right.
So let's talk a little bit about solutions then for folks who find themselves in that kind of situation. I've heard of different things, loan modification, short sales, that kind of thing. Can you sort of list the options that a person might consider for dealing with an unfortunate mortgage situation?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, I want to start. It's kind of interesting. You say the problem is the solution or the problem is the answer.
Absolutely.
And I think when people are in mortgage trouble, that is very much the case. So what happens when you're in mortgage trouble is, let's think about what happened, right? People are financially unstable.
Mm-hmm.
Their expenses are more than their income. So they are fundamentally financially unstable. That is the problem. In order to get back to financial stability, which is the solution, I like to explain it very simply. There are three doors that somebody in trouble can walk through.
Okay.
The first door is the door of home retention. If somebody wants to keep their home, there are certain programs, some of which apply to people that have short-term problems and some of which apply to people that have longer-term problems that help them keep their home even though they're in trouble. That's door number one. And
mm-hmm.
within that, for people with short-term problems, typically the solution is something called forbearance followed by a repayment plan.
Okay.
For people with longer-term problems, let me just describe the doors, Toby, and then we can dive into the doors if you'd like. For people with longer-term problems, they could keep their home if they qualify for a home retention problem, and the number one home retention program out there is a loan modification. So
okay.
I'm more than happy to talk about loan modifications. So door number one, choice number one is you could keep your home if you can qualify for some sort of a change to your mortgage that would enable you to keep that home by solving your problem, and which is also acceptable to whoever owns your loan. That's
okay.
door number one. Door number two is for people who cannot afford their home or who do not want to afford their home, who want to move. For instance, somebody who got unemployed and wants to have the flexibility to move to a different city or a different location to get a job. For
okay.
those people who want to move or need to move, they can still leave home but avoid foreclosure. And there's two foreclosure alternatives that they could pursue. The first one, the most common one, is something called a short sale, where the home is sold for less than the amounts owed on it. And the second option is something called a deed in lieu of foreclosure,
uh-huh.
where a homeowner signs over the paperwork to give back the home to the investors who own the home.
I have
and
a
then,
question
of course,
about
go ahead. Sure.
Right, I have a question about the short sale, if you could, so before we move on. You said that with a short sale, the home can be sold for less than what the homeowner owes on it. What happens to that balance?
All right. You asked me the most important question. So here's the two things that I would say in answering your question, first of all. What I have seen out there is that the number one misperception, the number one misunderstanding when somebody is going through a short sale is that often people assume that the amounts that are the short amounts, the difference between what they owed and what they paid back by selling the home, are going to be forgiven.
Hmm.
That is the most important mistake people made. It is very important to make sure that you understand and negotiate with the debt holders what happens to that short amount. Absolutely, the goal for somebody who's going through a short sale, particularly one who has a financial hardship, because remember, there's also people doing short sales because they think it's the right investment decision for them. So they may have a harder time negotiating debt forgiveness, but for somebody who's truly living in a home and facing a financial hardship, I believe debt forgiveness is the most important aspect of a short sale. And in fact, my company is the number one advocate for a program, for the only short sale program nationwide, that includes mandatory debt forgiveness on all the loans on a property. And that program, for anybody who's interested, is called HAFA, the Home Affordable Foreclosure Alternatives Program. It's created by the government. I do want to mention the number one misperception and misunderstanding for those who want a loan modification so they can keep their home is a lot of those people assume that they're somehow getting a write-down of the debt down to the value of the home today.
Okay.
And that is one thing that is a very that is a misunderstanding in almost every case. Very rarely is that homeowner actually getting a principal reduction today. 99% of loan modifications offered to people today do not include principal reductions. Those are two things that are very important for people to understand as they think about what they want to do if they're in trouble.
So what does get modified? Is it then just the interest rate that gets modified?
Let me give you some data. I'm a big fan of always looking to the government programs because we know the government tends to always watch out for the consumer, right? So the government-created modification program that's out there and available today is called HAMP. I wish the government didn't give these programs acronyms that are impossible to remember, but it's called HAMP, okay?
Okay. HAMP.
Home Affordable Modification Program.
Oh, HAMP.
There's about – sorry?
You said HAMP. With
HAMP, exactly.
Okay.
And what that means is Home Affordable Modification Program.
Right.
So let's talk about that for one quick second because I'll explain to you how that one works.
Mm-hmm.
So the HAMP program has helped 670,000 homeowners till date. Okay, 670,000 homeowners.
Right.
Those homeowners, the median homeowner, okay, the one in the middle, the median homeowner received a payment reduction on their mortgage of 37%. So
wow.
People who actually qualified for a Home Affordable Modification Program loan modification got a 37% reduction on their payment. So then, of course, your next question is, how do they get that reduction?
Yes.
All right, so let's understand that. 100% of those people received a reduction in their interest rate. The HAMP program allows interest rates to go down as low as 2% for a period of 5 years, after which they slowly start to inch up again. So 100% of those people got an interest rate reduction. 60% of those people got what is called an extension in the amortization term. So let's say that the loan that they originally got was being amortized, meaning the payments were being spread out over 30 years.
Yes.
That could be stretched out to 40 years, for instance.
Oh,
so 60% of those people got an extension in their amortization term. All right, let's keep going. The third thing that they got, 30% of those, and see the percentages going down. So
yes,
everybody doesn't get all of these reductions.
Mm-hmm.
100% got interest rate reductions. 60% got extensions in their amortization term. 30% got what is called principal forbearance, meaning let's say that their loan was $300,000, but they could only afford a loan for $200,000, and their investor decides to give them that. Well, in this case, the investor, in 30% of the cases, the investor deferred a portion of that principal. So they still owed the full amount of the loan,
mm-hmm.
but they had to pay that piece of the principal back only at the end.
Now,
called a balloon payment.
I was going to ask, is that a balloon payment? Right.
That's
okay.
A balloon payment. That's exactly mm-hmm. what a balloon payment is. Now, the million-dollar question. What percentage of them actually got a principal reduction?
Right. Where in
that
other
data
words,
is not disclosed.
You actually took off and said, you know what, we're forgiving you that amount of the price of the house.
Exactly. Your home was worth $500,000 5 years ago. It's worth $300,000 today. We're going to write it down to $300,000. That is almost never happening. In fact, when you look at the government data that's published on the 670,000 modifications I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
there's literally no data published on principal reductions, which makes me believe the number is close to zero.
Wow. Okay. You know, it brings me to ask a question in terms of these programs. We've talked about loan modification. We've talked about short sale. What incentives do the banks and the investors have to cooperate? I mean, it seems to me on the one hand that you want to have somebody living in the house and paying something rather than nothing. On the other hand, the behavior of, or at least what I'm hearing in terms of the reports of the behavior of the bank seems that they're, you know, trying to foreclose and get people out. What is that all about?
All right. So let's do this, Toby. The one thing that I want to say is when somebody's in trouble on their mortgage,
mm-hmm.
the word bank or lender actually becomes meaningless. So when you're actually borrowing money, this is sort of a complication that's holding up. I actually call the number of people that are in trouble today that have not been resolved. The number stands at 6.3 million homeowners.
Mm.
I call it the elephant in the python.
Okay. Okay.
And part of the reason for this is, and this is called a shadow inventory. I'm one of the people that believes we need to do something to solve that problem so we can stabilize the housing market. And I'm a
mm-hmm.
big advocate of doing something that's fair to all the parties. The most important parties when you're in trouble are who owns my loan? who's the actual investor on my loan. The person that actually sends a person a bill, so here's what I would say to somebody in trouble on their mortgage. Forget the word bank.
Okay.
You either have a loan servicer or you have a loan investor. Typically, the person that sends you your loan statement that collects the monies from you on a monthly basis, typically they don't actually loan your home. They don't actually own your loan. They're just servicing your loan. They're administering your loan contract on behalf of whoever owns your loan. The real decision maker actually is the loan investor. And part of the big problem that we've had is the loan investors have not been systematically brought to the table to cut a standard deal for homeowners. The government has largely been talking to loan servicers instead of the real decision makers, a loan investor. So the first thing that has to happen for a loan investor to give a defaulted homeowner any option, whether it be a loan modification, whether it be a short sale or a deed in lieu, the first thing that must happen is they must believe that whatever they're offering you is in their best interest.
Right.
Okay? So what they do in order to do that is they cut a deal. They make sure that deal is better for them than foreclosure. And the way they do that is by designing the program and calculating the value of all the options that are available via something called an NPV test, a net present value test. In other words, if I'm the loan investor and I'm trying to give a consumer a loan modification, I'm running two NPV calculations, and I'm only offering a loan modification or another foreclosure prevention option that has a better net present value for me, the loan investor, than foreclosure. So that's the fundamental underpinning of everything that's going on today.
Which, I mean, it makes sense. People who are investing are business people. They're in the business of, making money. They're not a charitable institution.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Right. So then that brings me to the kinds of situations that our caller spoke of, where you have people who come in saying, we can do this. We can negotiate, let's say, with whoever is the decision maker in this situation. And folks find themselves in really unfortunate situations when they find out that the company that they were contacted by or that they did business with actually was not telling the truth about that. How can people, or what kinds of things should people look for when they are vetting a company that they might hire to help them to negotiate? How can they see a scam coming?
So the simplest thing that I would tell people is, help is available for free, bottom line.
So you shouldn't
a consumer in default should never have to pay. They want to pay, so let's talk about that. If they want to pay, let's talk about the type of professional that does make sense. But they should, generally speaking, never have to pay. You can go to a HUD-approved counseling agency if you need help. You can call your loan servicer. Some people have had very poor experiences with the loan servicer. I admit that. So some people are not happy to call their loan servicer, but it's their loan servicer's job to help them for free. But a couple other things that people can do to get some help is go to a Department of Housing and Urban Development approved counseling agency, a HUD-approved counseling agency, and get help absolutely for free. When looking at somebody that you might want to pay, a couple things I would mention are, number one, a consumer should never have to pay anybody up front. So somebody who's taken payment for you up front, saying, I'll guarantee you a loan modification if you give me $3,000 or $5,000 up front, that is literally against the law.
Right.
Okay? So that should never be happening. People should never be guaranteeing a consumer an outcome because they cannot. At the end of the day, whatever outcome actually is offered to the consumer must be approved by the investor of their loan. Okay? So nobody can guarantee a consumer an outcome. So if you get... It comes down to bottom line, basic common sense and good business judgment. If someone is coming to you and doing a hard sell, claiming that they're going to guarantee you something, don't trust them. If they say, yes, I'll get paid if I get you something that you agree makes sense, fine. It's okay to hire somebody who will get paid if you're happy with what they're able to bring to the table for you. But you should never feel forced to pay somebody up front for something that you don't know if you're going to actually be helped.
Right. So I guess the key points there are, help is available for free. You shouldn't have to pay someone. But if you are going to hire someone, they shouldn't be asking for money up front, and they shouldn't be making any guarantees. If you see those two signs, at least those are big red flags that say stay away.
Exactly right. And one other thing for anybody who needs help, one quick number I want to point out is the Homeowners Hope Hotline, put together by the government supported. It's 888-995-HOPE. Literally, 888-995-HOPE is a great number for anybody to call to get some guidance here for free.
For those of you who are listening and you know, can't write it down right now, don't worry. It's on the blog. So if you go to untangledresolutions.blogspot.com, you'll be able to find this information there. Or just go to the FTC's website. And, again, it's a very well put together website, I have to say. I've explored it myself, and the information there is very available. Ray, we're running out of time, funnily enough. We're already coming down to the last few minutes of the show. I want to be sure that we get to the key features of a mortgage that consumers should understand before they take out a mortgage. At the beginning of the show, you talked about how when you bought your own home in 2002, with all the expertise that you have, you were confused. So are there any key features that a person, or key terminology that a person should understand when they are looking for a home?
You know, Tabi, one of the hard-won lessons that I've learned in life, and really it applies to anything, whether it's getting a mortgage or investing in a stock or buying something, the first thing I would tell somebody is, if you don't understand the loan you're getting, don't get it, okay? And I say this to people who are investing in a stock. If you don't understand why you're investing in something and how it works, just don't do it. So that's the first thing that I would say. Couple tips on things to watch out for. What is your interest rate and when can it change and by how much? Is there a prepayment penalty of any kind, meaning if you wanted to refinance within the next 1, 2, 3, 4 years, would you actually have to pay the person who gave you your mortgage to get out of it? A third thing that very few people looked at, which is really biting a lot of people today, is the loan something called recourse or non-recourse, meaning if you go into default on the loan and have trouble paying it, can the party that is making you the loan come after you personally, or can they only go after the home? That is another really important term and aspect of the loan for people to understand.
Right. Okay. Wonderful. You know, what I'll do is talk with you a little bit more after, and if there's more information about this that is really important, I'll be sure to put that up on the blog. Ray, I want to get a really quick answer on this as well. We got a question from one of our regular listeners. Does it make sense in this environment to rent rather than buy?
You know, there's no right or wrong answer on that, Toby. You know, on the one hand, I would tell you, I think there's never been, I got pretty upset, you know, a few months ago when I saw Time magazine, which so many mainstream Americans read, talk about, you know, the end of home ownership, the end of the American dream. I get pretty upset because I'm a believer in America, and I think the American dream is not about home ownership. It's about opportunity, okay? I don't think Americans should give up the American dream of home ownership. In fact, I think the combination of home prices and mortgage rates makes home ownership more affordable than it's been in a long, long time in America. So I think it's a very good time for people to contemplate home ownership. On the other hand, home ownership isn't for everyone. Even if you can afford a home, it may be better for you to rent if you think you're going to have to move. For instance, the transaction costs of buying and selling a home are very high. There's very few transactions under which you might end up paying 8 or 10% of the value of the transaction just to do the transaction.
Right.
So the transaction costs of home ownership are really high. There's no right or wrong answer. Certainly, a lot of people should be renting instead of buying, but there's no single answer for everyone. It's also a good time to look at home ownership. And the one other thing I want to say before I hang up is, in addition to the FTC guide, for anybody who's actually in trouble on their mortgage, a website I hope and recommend they check out is called Making Home Affordable. It's a government website. I always send people to government sources. Go to www.makinghomeaffordable.gov for a lot of information on some good government programs that could help people out.
Wonderful. Ray, you have been the best. Thank you so very much. And for the folks who have been listening, I'm so glad that you chose to join us this week. I hope that you've benefited from the information we've presented today. And if you have more questions or want to get in touch with Ray and her organization, send me a message, info@123untangled.com, and that's an email address, or visit the show's blog, as I've said, untangledresolutions.blogspot.com, and I'll have all the information that you've heard today, plus information about today's featured artist as well, posted for your convenience. Ray, thank you so much.
You're so very welcome. It was my pleasure. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, for next week, if you have a business or have ever thought of starting one, be sure to tune in. We talked a little bit about how unemployment is driving a lot of the mortgage problems today, and so a lot of people are becoming entrepreneurs. Next week, my guest is Pankaj Amin, who is a successful entrepreneur and private equity specialist who recently sold his business and specializes in fixing up small to medium-sized companies for sale. He will talk about what investors look for and how you can become the next Martha Stewart or Michael Dell. Yes, you can. That's what's in store for next week. I'm going to leave you with another piece by Michael Gregory. This one is appropriate called Don't Ever Give Up on Yourself. Don't you ever give up on yourself. And it's from his album, Towards the Sun. Don't you ever give up on yourself. Have a wonderful week, everyone. Goodbye.
Come on.